Hey, good morning. Welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Glad to have you with us. We're going to be talking about money, your money, in the thrift savings plan, which my colleague Jack Moore reported recently has just gone over the $400 billion mark. That's a lot of money. My guest today, leadoff guest, is Arthur Stein. He's a financial planner well-known in federal circles and based in Rockville.
Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay. All right. We appreciate you coming down into the
studio today.
And your background just fascinates me. Real quickly, you worked on the Hill, and you worked overseas in Australia and Botswana?
Yeah. I was an economist for the government of Botswana for 2 years. I was in their Ministry of Finance. I used to negotiate treaties and aid agreements for them and all kinds of things. I was a Peace Corps volunteer then. And then I went to Australia. I taught in a university, and I came back here. So on the House Ways and Means Committee, I was a staff economist on the House Ways and Means Committee.
That's wild. And that was in the days when the House Ways and Means Committee was a household word almost, at least in the Washington area.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. And now you're handling people's thrift savings plan accounts, among other things.
Well, I'm advising federal employees and helping them invest their money.
Right. Susie Orman was in town recently. And I saw the taping of the show, and she had said she knew all about the TSP. Obviously, she boned up on it, but she knew all about it. And she said, take advantage of that 5% matching max that the government will give you.
Yeah, absolutely. For FERS employees, the first 5% that they contribute to the TSP is matched by the federal government. They put in 5% for you. So if you're putting in less than 5%, you're making a huge mistake because you're passing up, you know, free money. It's like they just increase your income 5%. And, you know, when new employees come in, the default option is they sign them up for a 3% contribution. I don't know why it's not 5, but people should be proactive. They should make sure they're putting in at least 5%.
Right. And they're talking about changing that default to possibly one of the life cycle funds. Have you heard that?
Yeah. There is a bill before Congress. It's passed the relevant committee, and it would make the default a fund that new contributions go into for new employees be what they call an age-appropriate life cycle fund. And they leave it up to the TSP to determine what the age-appropriate fund is. It's a much better choice than the G fund, in my opinion. Over long periods of time, you would absolutely expect one of the L funds to have a higher rate of return than the G fund in most years. Now, not every year. The L funds can and have gone down in value, even on a calendar year basis. But I think for people, you know, who are going to be working for a lot of years, that's a much better choice. And it doesn't mean it's the best choice. You know, the best choice for people is to sit down, figure out how much they can contribute. Hopefully it's a lot more than 3%. And, you know, they could easily be better off by doing a combination of the CS and I funds and maybe some in the F and G funds and just stick to that allocation through good times and bad. And as decades go by, I think they're going to be better off. Because with the L fund, the life cycle funds, they start off 90% in stocks, the C and the S and the I fund. Those are the stock funds. And only 10% in the F and G funds. But they become increasingly conservative as time goes by. And they finally end up in what's called the L income fund, which is going to be only 20% in the stock funds. And 74% in the G fund, the government securities fund, and 6% in the F fund, the bond fund. And it means you end up with 74% of your retirement funds in the TSP fund that is expected to have the lowest rate of return. And I don't think people can really afford that unless they happen to have a lot of money and a very low cost of living.
Right. So your concern is that they're going to that inflation will eat up.
Inflation is going to eat away. And, you know, another mistake that a lot of people make, you know, they look at their TSP account and they think, oh, gee, I got $300,000 in the TSP, so I'll be able to spend $300,000. Well, that's not true. You've got $300,000 minus taxes. So when you take out your $300,000, you might only end up after taxes with around $200,000. And if you have invested in such a conservative manner that your investments have not kept up with inflation, then that's a double whammy and you're really in trouble.
Would it help any if, say that they were going to put me down into this present income fund and I said, no, I want the 2030. That would change the mix, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you can, if you're in, say, the L-2030 fund because you expect to start withdrawing money in 2030 from the TSP to live on, you can switch to the 2040 or the 2050 fund, and that will be, you know, a more aggressive investment allocation. And, you know, just for people who don't know, you know, as I just said, you know, the funds gradually become more conservative. And when we talk about the L40 and the L50 and the L30, that's the year in which the fund hits its most conservative allocation, and then it stays with that allocation forever. And that allocation is called the L income fund, and that's the allocation which is 80% in the F and G funds and only 20% in the CS&I funds, the stock funds.
Right, and you don't like that because of the inflation
factor. To me, it seems too conservative. Because remember, you may start taking money out of your TSP account in 2030 because, let's say, that's the year you retired, but you could easily, you know, be retired for 20 or 30 or in some cases 40 years, and you want money to be available to spend 10, 20, 30 years later. You don't want that money that you need 10, 20, and 30 years from now to be in a conservative investment.
Okay, totally. Take a short break here talking with Arthur Stein. We'll be right back on federalnewsradio.com.
What are the fiscal management and performance challenges facing government executives? What is the goal of GAO's high-risk list, and what are some of the key high-risk areas? How can audit agencies change the way they do business to properly respond to 21st century governance challenges? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Chris Mim, Managing Director, Strategic Issues, Government Accountability Office. Tune in on Mondays at 11 for the Business of Government Hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The American Veterans Center invites you to attend the 2014 National Memorial Day Parade, Monday, May 26th at 2 p.m. along Constitution Avenue. Join thousands as we honor the sacrifices of our military from the American Revolution to today, featuring musical performances, marching bands, celebrities, and active duty personnel, all made possible with support from Strayer University, Wells Fargo, and visitmyrtlebeach.com. To learn more about how you can see the parade, visit nationalmemorialdayparade.com.
Everyone in D.C. talks about cutting the cost of this or increasing the performance of that. But no one talks about just how they're going to do it. Well, we're talking about it. We're Brocade. And Brocade can make your organization's network so agile and efficient, jaws will drop and costs will plummet. Dramatically. So say goodbye to your old complicated network and hello to the automated network of tomorrow. Say hello to Brocade. Get the facts at brocade.com/networkfacts.
Here's Neil Shelley, lead for the Data Center Consolidation Program at the U.S. Army, on the Federal Executive Forum on Virtualization and Data Center Consolidation, sponsored by Dell Software.
The Army's been very aggressive. We've found over 1,200 data centers by the OMB definition, and we've closed 227 of those so far. And by closing a lot of those smaller data centers, we certainly are increasing our security posture and gaining efficiencies.
To listen to the entire program made possible by the Trezor Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Dell Software Solutions for data center consolidation and virtualization help you transform your infrastructure and optimize application and service delivery. Manage physical, virtual, and cloud environments and a full range of endpoint systems. Monitor application performance. Perform zero-impact migrations. Do more with Dell Software, available through DLT Solutions. Learn more at dlt.com/Dell Software. That's dlt.com/Dell Software.
Learn how to decode the government finance and performance puzzle at the 2014 Government Performance Summit, May 6 and 7. Attendees will participate in lively discussions and gain hands-on experience applicable to any government organization. The low-cost, two-day training event hosted by the Association of Government Accountants and the Performance Institute addresses the various methods used to make key decisions tied to government finance and performance. agacgfm.org/GPS.
Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 9, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO to hear from your agency's top tech leader how technology is changing government. Tech Tuesday on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Arthur Stein, a financial planner based in Bethesda. A lot of interesting background and experience. Ellen Cortesoya is running the board today for Lauren Larson. Lauren is off gallivanting somewhere, isn't she, Ellen? Yeah. We don't know what she's doing, but we sure will. We're talking before the break about long retirements, and it picked up the Washington Post this morning. Look at the sports section, and I see that Connie Marrero, a pitcher for the Washington Senators, the old Washington Senators, is still in retirement in Cuba. He's 102 years old.
Oh, is that right?
And yeah. Baseball pitchers, I assume, retire in their 40s. So he has been possibly retired for 60 years.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, people underestimate how long a retirement they need to plan for. I mean, lots of us have heard, and, you know, I think it's true that the average 65-year-old lives to 83. And so many people then think, well, I'm going to plan my retirement assuming that I die at 83. And this is a big mistake. If the average 65-year-old lives to 83, it means that half those people are going to live longer than that. And, you know, for people who are in good health now, taking care of themselves, of course, feds have great health insurance. And, you know, if you quit smoking, you don't drink a lot, I mean, you have an excellent chance of living into your 90s and beyond. I mean, my dad died at 91. Why shouldn't I outlive my dad by 5 or 10 years at least? I mean, think how much better healthcare is going to be in 20 and 30 years.
Yeah, well, I think, yeah, and particularly to people in this market, not just Washington, but in the federal market, but they are in many ways in the elite among the country in health and income and education. So they're going to be on the high side.
Yeah, and you know, if you plan for a long retirement, you die early. I mean,
yeah,
that's a personal tragedy, but it's not a financial tragedy. But you know, if you think you're going to die at 83 or 5 and your money runs out then and you're still alive, I mean, then that's a personal and a financial tragedy, and you do not want to be in that situation.
There's a commercial, I'm sure you've seen it on television, and they start out with a group of people in the center, and they give them a yellow tape, and they say, guess how long how much money do you have, and how long do you think it will last you? And nearly everybody underestimates it. You know, they don't have enough money to last their likely time on this earth.
Yeah, and you know, the feds, you're really in a great situation because you have this federal annuity, and of course CSRS has full cost of living adjustment, very high percentage rate. But even FERS employees at FERS annuity, it's fabulous. It's going to last your lifetime. Cost of living adjustment isn't quite as good, but it's still way better than anything that people have in the private sector. And you've got Social Security on top of that. So you don't have an excuse to run out of money. I mean, you're never going to run out of money. You're always going to have your federal annuity and Social Security payments coming in. What you're worried about is that you're going to hit a period where you need to supplement that fixed income that you have with money withdrawn from your investments. And if you haven't handled your investments correctly, they could run out and then you're in trouble.
Right. And you have to start making minimum withdrawals. Is it 70 and a half?
Yeah. When you hit 70 and a half, if you're no longer working for the federal government, you have to start making what are called required minimum distributions, not only from the TSP, but any IRAs you have, unless they're a Roth IRA. But it doesn't mean that you have to spend the money. You just have to take it out of that tax-deferred account If you don't need it to spend, you can reinvest it, or you can spend it.
You said the magic word there, the Roth IRA. What do you think of Roths and the federal program?
Yeah. Okay, so federal employees now have a choice. Their TSP contributions can either go into their regular IRA or what's called a Roth IRA. And the Roth IRA is named after Senator Roth from,
Delaware.
Know, mm-hmm. Delaware, who, you know, initially proposed this. The difference is the contribution limits are the same. With the regular TSP, the money that you put in is what's called tax deductible. It reduces your taxable income. So if you put in $10,000 in 2013, your taxable income for 2013 was reduced by $10,000. And years later, when you take money out of the regular TSP, all the money you take out is going to be fully taxable. With the Roth TSP, everything is identical except that the money that you put in is not tax deductible. It will not reduce your taxable income that year. But when you take the money out, there's no tax on it. And this can be a huge advantage because maybe over your lifetime you contribute $100,000 into the TSP. If it goes into a Roth account and, you know, your investments have done very well and maybe now they're worth $250,000, then you traded a $100,000 tax deduction to get $250,000 in tax-free income. And especially for younger people who are, you know, have currently a lower salary than they'll probably have in the future. In the future, you know, if they have a higher salary, higher income, their tax rate is likely to be higher, which again makes the Roth TSP very advantageous. And because the money, when you take the money out of the Roth TSP, not only is it tax-free, it reduces your adjusted gross income because it's not taxable, and it may therefore reduce your Medicare premiums, which go up as your income goes up, and it can reduce the taxes you have on your Social Security benefit because that's based on your income too. So it can be lots of advantages to the Roth TSP.
It's hard to I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's hard to explain something like to a young person. Oftentimes you don't have money. You're not thinking about 40 years down the road and retiring. But if there was some way you could sit them down and say, trust me, this Roth is, it's too good to be true.
Yeah, and, you know, it's too bad. I mean, I hate it when younger people especially don't sit down with somebody and get advice. Because the decisions they make, because they are young, they have a lot of leverage. And the Roth TSP question is a very important decision to make. The other very important decision that lots of younger employees get wrong is, you know, just the investment allocation. I mean, I've seen, you know, federal employees and non-federal employees, but say federal employees, you know, who all their TSP contributions are going into the G fund. And, you know, they're looking 20, 30 years down the road is when they're going to access the money. And that's a terrible decision for younger people. They should be much more aggressive investors.
Well, and when you have situations like the market downturn in 2008, 2009, people fled the stock funds. So they sold low. They went into the G fund, which was paying next to nothing. They remain there. Now that stocks are booming again, people are feeling frisky, and they're saying, I want to go back. I want a piece of that action. And so now they're going back, and they're going to be buying high, correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's people don't do a good job of the average person does not do a good job of managing investments. There have been lots of studies on this. And basically, you know, the average investor, most investors tend to buy high and sell low, which is the opposite way that you would make money in stocks and bonds. You want to buy low and sell high. It's because they get enthused when the stock market's doing well and they start buying. They get discouraged when it's down and they sell. So they're buying after it's gone up, selling after it's gone down, and then wondering why their investments aren't doing well. And again, you want to find the appropriate allocation and stick with it unless there's some kind of change in your life that would dictate a different allocation?
You know, back in the day, a couple of years ago, before the markets went up and down, there was all this pressure to allow literally day trading in the thrift savings plan, and people could do it. And there were, the TSP estimated, I think there were 4,000 to 5,000 people who were or would be regular day traders. And every time we or someone else would publish anything against the or about the evils and dangers of day trading, we'd get swamped with emails, and they actually set up a newsletter to attack me and other people like me who said that day trading just doesn't work. And several of them called. They weren't hostile or anything, but they were angry. And several of them called or emailed and said they were successful day traders. And I asked them to send me a record of their investments. Never got one.
Yeah, I mean, I find a lot of people manage their own investments always feel like they're doing well, but they don't keep records as to, you know, like what actually was their return on their investments minus expenses last year, the last 5 years. And then, you know, the nice thing about the funds in the TSP and mutual funds and exchange traded funds is you can find out exactly what the return has been. And day traders don't do that. And, you know, the TSP cracked down on that. They definitely made the right decision. Now you can only make 2 inter-fund transfers per month. Except once you've made 2 in that calendar month, you can always switch money into the G fund. But it means you can't day trade, and that was a good decision. It, you know, it's like requiring people to get motorcycle helmets and seat belts. You know, you're requiring them to do something that's good for them, or in this case, you're preventing them from doing something that's not only bad for them individually, but raises the expenses of the TSP and therefore is bad for just the other people who are investing in the TSP.
Jack Moore, Federal News Radio, reported last year that the TSP had commissioned, I guess, Mercer and Company to do a study for them, and that a number of proposals were in the works. They're not necessarily going to happen, but there are a number of proposals. And I think one was emerging markets, and the other was another small cap or international fund.
Yeah, what they looked at is whether additional funds should be added to the L funds, the life cycle funds. And they weren't, I don't know why, but they were not looking at adding the same fund to the, you know, the 5 funds that are already there. You can only invest in this through the L funds. And they looked at emerging markets, international small cap stocks, global real estate investment trusts, and commodities. And what they found was that the one sector that had the biggest effect on the performance of the L funds was emerging markets. So these are international stocks from what we used to call less developed countries, South American countries, you know, countries like China, Cambodia, Vietnam, etc. And I actually read the report yesterday, and, you know, Mike, I think I should get more money for reading that report, except you don't pay me money
at
all.
The check is in the mail. So. Let's take a break here.
Okay, please give me a break.
And we'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com.
Here's David Bray, CIO of the FCC, on the Catalyst for Government's Big Data Revolution panel discussion sponsored by NetApp and CDWG.
I think our key strategy is recognizing the FCC that our real value is in the persistence and the permanence of our data. Applications will come and go, and particularly when we look at mobile, I mean, the average app of a mobile app is less than 5 months. And so we're looking at that things will come and go on the UI space. But we really want to make that data available as much as possible to our partners, the public, as well as ourselves.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
What does all the buzz about big data mean for federal agencies? It means your agency can gain insight with analytics for large data sets. Go fast with bandwidth that supports data-intensive workloads and keep all your content with secure, boundless data storage. That's what you can do with an effective big data solution, but it's only from CDWG and NetApp. To learn how to turn your data challenges into data-driven insight, visit cdwg.com/netapp. That's cdwg.com/netapp.
Psoriasis and vitiligo are serious diseases. You've tried everything and have been disappointed. Now there's XTRAC, a breakthrough treatment that provides long-lasting, safe relief. XTRAC is FDA-cleared for the treatment of psoriasis and vitiligo and is endorsed by thousands of dermatologists and hospitals because it works. Clinical studies show immediate results with up to 95% clearance. The in-office visits are fast, painless, with virtually no side effects. With thousands of providers treating patients all over the country, XTRAC is covered by all major insurance companies and Medicare. We'll help you find a doctor close by. And there is no cost to you until you see results. Get your life back. Live free. Live XTRAC clear. For your no-cost treatment, call now 800-959-9852. That's 800-959-9852. 800-959-9852. Or visit xtracradio.com. Qualified patients, certain restrictions apply. Results may vary.
What makes train unstoppable? Why is it hard to stop a train? Did you know that the Train Climatuff compressor was the world's first successful heat pump compressor? Did you know that one Climatuff compressor, nicknamed Snowball, ran for nearly 28 years before it passed away? Visit trainsearch.com to learn more and to locate an independent train comfort specialist dealer near you. Be sure to ask them about Train Climatuff compressors. They will explain what makes train different, better, unstoppable. It's hard to stop a train, really hard.
Federal News Radio's Jason Miller is on Twitter. Follow him at jmillerwfed for the latest IT and federal management news at jmillerwfed.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive.
Willie Taylor is director of the Office of Environmental Policy and Compliance at the Interior Department.
So the structure that we've got, it's really been useful getting ideas from our staff about how we should deal with sustainability. Being at Interior, you have a certain mindset to take care of the land and take care of the resources, and they give us some fantastic ideas because it's not something you would think of just sitting at headquarters.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
Acquisition and Industry Thursday on Federal News Radio. At 9, listen for the Coalition for Government Procurements Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron, where procurement policy meets process. At 11, Bloomberg Government hosts Capital Impact, focusing on the business implications of government actions, and hear from companies themselves on policy, regulations, and trends on Industry Chatter with Francis Rose Thursdays at 4. Acquisition and Industry Thursday on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Back to your turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Amber Corrin and Andy Medici from the Federal Times. Andy, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, Andy, and I was afraid you were going to boycott us. Be your first day here.
No, we like being on.
Very good. Okay. I don't know if you heard me. I was sort of rattling on about what we wanted to talk about.
There's a lot to talk about this week. You know, you were saying there's Public Service Recognition Week, and I feel like we have come a little bit since previous years. There's finally been at least a little bit of a pay raise. Some of sequestration has been lifted, so there is some silver lining to the cloud this year.
Well, speaking of clouds, I prophesied last week that it rains every Public Service Recognition Week. Maybe we're going to get it out of the way this time.
Maybe we can get through, but you know, you're right, Mike. I wouldn't bet against you this time.
Yeah, it just seems that the clouds are there. Amber, you said there was a big loss at the Pentagon with the CIO.
There was actually Terry Takai, who's been the DOD CIO for about the past 3 years or so, is stepping down as of the end of this week.
3 years is a long time in that job, isn't it?
It is. That's actually a pretty long tenure for a CIO.
Well, explain something to me, because I'm the ultimate layman. What does a CIO do now? We have CEOs, CIOs, HPOs. What does a CIO do?
So the chief information officer generally tends to steer a lot of the IT related policy at an organization. At a place like the Defense Department, Terry Takai is in charge of a lot of the defense IT policies. She was the driver behind the Army moving to Defense Enterprise Email. She's been helping drive the Defense Department-wide transition to something called the Joint Information Environment. So she's been really a big supporter of shared IT services across the military services.
Well, this, of course, is the last 2 years of the administration, so you're going to see a lot of people. She's not a political person, I assume, but you're going to be seeing lots of people who are getting out and going into the private sector.
Yes, there actually already has been a lot of transition. Her deputy, Rob Carey, who was in the government for about 30 years, left last month. And we've also seen major departures from the Deputy Chief Management Office, which is another Defense Department agency that has a lot to do with defense IT policy. So you're already starting to see a lot of that transition happening. And there's really no word yet on who will replace her.
Andy, we've got a batch of people who were hired since February of this year, so they're brand new federal workers, and they're already getting some bad news.
Yeah, you're right, Mike. You see, new federal employees, those hired after January of this year, have to pay 4.4% of their salaries into the employment retirement system. But a lot of agencies, especially in the Defense Department, are unable to process those higher contributions, so they haven't been having them taken out. And at some point, when they get those systems running, they're going to have to pay all the back pay. And that could amount to up to $1,300 for these new employees. So you have the head of the AFGE saying that OMB has the ability to waive those fees as erroneous payments and not have federal employees pay that much out of pocket once these systems are up and running.
I was going to ask you what the precedent is for that. I'm sure they could also argue that it was just a simple mistake and you got to keep the money that much longer.
Well, yeah, the OMB does have the ability to waive that. Whether or not they will is unclear. We haven't had these sorts of changes, these sorts of increases and changes in pension contributions in a while. And there's three tiers now. There's 4.4%. There's people hired last year at 3.1%. There's everyone hired before that at about 0.8%. So you have to create these tiered systems, and a lot of agencies just weren't able to do it in time.
So a 1%er has a different meaning in the government then, doesn't it?
It definitely does, Mike.
Yeah. Andy, you mentioned something in our exchange about the newly passed Data Act. What's that about? Is it a big deal?
Well, a lot of managers and a lot of leaders at agencies will definitely think it's a big deal. It's something every federal employee should at least be aware of. But essentially, it was a bill passed out of the House and out of Congress entirely the other day that asks agencies to set government-wide data standards to make that data more transparent and to essentially publish spending data at every level down through the program level through contractors on usaspending.gov. So the idea is that it's going to push a lot of government data to the forefront, and agencies are going to have to work to make sure that their data is the same as other agencies and contractors.
Amber, I saw a briefing on television, a national security briefing, and the director of the CIA and some others were talking about the fact that the U.S. government is under attack, hundreds of thousands of attacks daily, computers, hackers from crazy people, from foreign governments, from enemies of America, and presumably some of our friends. And this idea of computer security and password security, it fascinates me and frightens me. And we, you know, we had that, is it Heartbleed?
Yes, Heartbleed.
Heartbleed, and that was the one that hit Target?
Actually, the Target hack was separate. Heartbleed is an exploit or a shortage or it's an area in the software that was a software glitch. That actually is separate from the Target hack.
Okay, no, it wasn't a hack at all. Then it was
no, it's not
okay.
A hack, yeah.
All right. Now the Target thing—they got, I think, 70 million people's information, which is scary. And I know an awful lot of Americans now bank online. How secure or not are bank accounts? People who are banking online.
Well, most of the banks in the aftermath of Heartbleed came out and said that they weren't affected by it. Heartbleed specifically targeted something called the OpenSSL, which is a transportation layer. Don't ask me to explain what that means. But basically, it has to do with the type of security that they're using on the website. And banks use a different type of security. So they generally have said that they weren't affected by Heartbleed specifically.
Now, the Thrift Savings Plan has been hit at least once, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Mike. In the past, there was some attacks against the thrift savings plan.
And that's scary because of the kinds of people who have thrift savings plan accounts. You have Secret Service agents and FBI personnel and Homeland Security. So that it's an even worse situation than it when it hits the private sector.
Well, I think the thrift savings plan has such a huge number of people involved and a huge amount of assets, and it's in the caretakership of the government that I think people hold it to a very high standard. And when there are attacks against it, I think you're right, it affects a lot of people in a lot of sensitive positions. And, you know, sometimes when you have security clearance, your financial situation matters. So I think there's always concern to be extra cautious about things like that.
Yeah, that's right. If people with a top security clearance, if they come up with a bad credit rating, they can lose it. And that's tantamount to losing your job.
Exactly. So I think for a lot of these security issues, it really is vitally important. And I think that's why there's so much more awareness of cybersecurity now, is it percolates so many aspects of our lives that we need to make sure that everything's secure.
Okay. What's the latest, if any, on the pay raise, and what numbers are we talking about here?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is that there's common ground, but the bad news is at 1%. And I think that's something that they're going to be stuck at for a while, unless it becomes part of something larger. The idea that federal employees should get a pay raise, a lot of people are objecting even to that. So that 1% is where a lot of people are stuck now. There are members of Congress who are pushing for, you know, 3.3%, sometimes a little bit higher. And a lot of what they're doing is essentially just trying to move the needle so that the discussion is no longer about how many years there's going to be a pay raise, but about how much the raise should be. And that discussion is worth having.
That's right, because at one point you had the 1% from the White House, 3.3% from a coalition of pro-federal workers. And a lot of people were saying they'd be lucky to get anything. It wasn't an either-or. They'd be lucky. So it's moved. I guess this is more good news than bad news, huh?
Well, it is. I think federal employees have suffered a lot over the last few years in terms of pay freezes, sequestration, and furlough days. And I think that there has been a little bit of give. I think 1% is the magic number. So although it's not good, it's something. And I think any direction away from a perpetual pay freeze is probably good news.
Good. Listen, we need to take a short break here. But when we come back, I'd like to ask you guys about what you're working on and also the outlook for buyouts. We'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com.
Hey, foodies! The National Harbor Wine and Food Festival is Saturday and Sunday, May 3rd and 4th. Enjoy wining and dining from some of the nation's finest purveyors. Visit wineandfoodnh.com. Sample over 150 different wines, beers, and spirits. The cooking stage features hands-on cooking demonstrations and wine pairings that offer fun for all guests. Join Foodie and the Beast, Nikki and David Nellis, for a live taping of the show on Saturday at 1 p.m. Go to wineandfoodnh.com for your tickets.
The Pentagon and Beyond is brought to you by Airbus Group.
Secretary of State John Kerry says Egypt has made progress in its democratic transition, but it has to address disturbing developments if its government is to have the confidence of the Egyptian people and the West. More specifically, Senator Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, said he won't approve sending any money to the Egyptian military, denouncing what he called a sham trial in which a court sentenced 683 people to death. I'm G.G. Green.
Airbus Group is proud to be a leading member of the U.S. aerospace and defense industry and to support almost 250,000 American jobs every day. From large commercial airliners to modern Army helicopters, from Coast Guard patrol aircraft to border security solutions, we support our defense, homeland security, and commercial customers so they can serve our fellow citizens. One global company, one common goal, one name to remember. Airbus.
Here's Terry McCall, deputy of the Joint Program Management Office, DIA, on the Transformation Technology Desktop Virtualization and Government Panel, sponsored by Dell and Iron Bow Technologies.
We basically use those technologies to provide services for 18,000 thin clients across two network domains, hosted out of 7 locations globally. The big benefit for us has been in user mobility, the fact that we do have a global customer base, and so this gives a lot of flexibility for customers in terms of whether they're logging in at different thin clients, different buildings, actually different locations around the world.
With rising cybersecurity threats as well as an increasingly mobile and future-ready workforce, desktop virtualization makes sense, right? So what is stopping your organization from making the move? If costs and organizational roadblocks come to mind, you are not alone. Let the desktop virtualization experts from Dell and Iron Bow Technologies help you overcome these barriers to adoption. Put the power of desktop virtualization in the hands of your users. Visit ironbow.com to learn more.
I don't know about you, but I've had a pretty busy week. Luckily, Marvin Bond, editor of Recreation News, has some ideas that are so great, I'll probably forget the week ever even happened.
Well, if you look south into Orange County, Virginia, you'll find the Montpelier Wine Festival takes place at the home of President James Madison on May the 3rd and 4th. They always have lots of family entertainment for this festival, in addition to the wine tastings all weekend. You can find out more about that on page 33 of the April Recreation News, or as always, at recreationnews.com.
Any other ideas on how to relax this weekend?
How about public archaeology days at the Jefferson Patterson Park and Museum? This is a great opportunity to get your hands dirty working with real archaeologists on one of the richest sites in Maryland. It's down in the southern Maryland area in Calvert County, or you can just be a spectator and watch if you like. The public archaeology days are Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays, beginning on May the 6th and going through June 28th.
Marvin Bond is editor of Recreation News. I'm Nicola Grisco.
Government IT professionals, registration for management of change is now open. Reserve your seat at this premier education and training event. Join your government and industry colleagues as we recapture the excitement of government service through breakthrough innovations and fresh ideas. Hosted by the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council, Management of Change will be held May 18th through the 20th in Cambridge, Maryland. Register today at www.actiac.org. That's actiac.org.
Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu is on Twitter. Follow him at jserbuwfed for the latest news about the Defense Department and defense contracting at jserbuwfed. Management Friday on Federal News Radio. Friday mornings at 10, listen for the American Federation of Government Employee Workforce Perspective on Inside Government. Next at 11, Shaw, Bransford, and Roth talk about the legal implications of management decisions on Fed Talk. And at noon, listen for Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch to learn the best career path for you. Management Friday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Back to your turn. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with Amber Corrin and Andy Medici from the Federal Times, and we've covered a lot of topics this morning. Andy and Amber, please chime in. What's the situation with buyouts? You know, this time last year, we had a batch of them. There were a lot in 2011. I think the IRS had two rounds of buyouts, and some people might think that the problem has been solved, problem being too many people, but with the new budget agreement, the two-year budget agreement, and sequestration, which is sort of like a python that keeps tightening and tightening. It looks like the agencies are cutting staff almost across the board.
You're right, Mike. There are still staff cuts going on. At the Air Force, they've said that over the course of the year and next year, they're going to be offering some buyouts, some early retirements. But what a lot of agencies are going to be doing, too, that you have to watch for is attrition, where they just people leave and they just don't replace them. And that can affect everyone else in that office who has to pick up the extra slack. And the Postal Service, for example, said that they're looking at a loss of 10,000 people next year through attrition, and that they just want that number to go below that as well if they could. So I think that's one of the big things we'll have to look at. There will be some buyouts, not as many as in previous years, but there will be a lot of attrition as agencies look to sort of keep their numbers down.
Something I had heard, someone was telling me that at the Office of Personnel Management, the big program emphasis has been on diversity and you know, more diversity in government. And I was thinking about going back to the Clinton years when buyouts started. The president wanted to reduce government by something like 370,000 jobs. And somebody explained the rules to them, the RIF rules, and that is it's the last hired, first fired. And many of the people that had been hired by the administration were women and minorities. So they said, if we run a RIF, they will be bumped out of their jobs by these older, mostly men, who have veterans' preference. And so they came up with the idea of buyouts as a way to protect the diversity gains. They did make the cuts. There were relatively few reductions in force. A lot of federal jobs were contracted out to the private sector or consolidated. Do you think something like that could happen again?
sort of wide-scale buyouts and,
yeah,
and rips. I don't see that happening as much. There's been a lot of buyouts and a lot of cuts in the last few years, and I think with the sequestration relief, you're not going to see things on that scale. However, the sequestration relief only lasts for a couple years, and then, as you said before, it sort of tightens around the federal government again. And if it does, you know, all bets are off. And if the Defense Department ends up getting BRAC authority and authorization, they're going to be reducing civilian employee populations by at least several percentage points. So those are all things to watch for. They all exist in the hypothetical, but they can very easily become reality.
Well, I'm always intrigued when they talk about, even discuss having a reduction in force, a RIF, because it's so messy, because you do have older people, senior people, veterans bumping younger people out of the jobs. And while you may get the numbers you're looking for, you don't retain the people that you need and want.
Well, that's true. Reductions in force, you know, a lot of agencies see that as a last resort, and I think a lot of people do. It's a very poor solution to a very important problem, and I think agencies would rather get buyout authorization, do early retirements, or do some sort of reorganization in order to avoid that. But sometimes, you know, as we both know, in the government, you have to make the numbers work, and if they have to do a RIF in order to do that, then that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, okay. Amber, you're new to Federal Times.
Yes, I am.
Okay. I covering a beat like IT is so absolutely daunting to me. Where do you start?
Well, I actually mostly focus on the Defense Department, and I've been doing this for a few years now, so that's kind of my little corner of the universe. I focus a lot on defense IT, a lot on cybersecurity, and those kinds of related things.
Well, and I guess that's some of the most important IT in the world.
It is, and there's a lot of money being spent on it, and it's a very big agency.
I guess when you drive the corridor from D.C. to Dulles, and you look at the companies on either side, and you see how important the defense dollars are, but the IT dollars are to the Washington area.
Definitely. You know, I actually drive that corridor every day to and from work, and it's just, you know, one defense contractor after another, and increasingly more and more of them are really IT-focused companies. So there's definitely a lot of that. You know, you're seeing references to Northern Virginia as like a mini Silicon Valley, so that's definitely something that is affecting our region for sure.
Well, I had a relative in town over the weekend. He's from Oklahoma City or thereabouts, and he just couldn't get over the wealth in the area, you know, the outdoor restaurants and the things. Not that Oklahoma City is a cow town, but he was bowled over by it. And I said, well, we have this underlay of the federal government, and then we have the defense contractors and the other federal contractors, and then the IT thing pretty much on the Virginia side, and the biotech on the Maryland side. And this is a very an area that's kind of in a bubble.
Absolutely. It's really become a way of life here.
All right. Andy, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm actually looking at postal reform. You know, this is that sort of perennial topic that just like paying benefits on the federal employee side, keeps popping up.
Round up the usual suspects.
Exactly. And in this case, postal reform, a lot of opponents are pointing towards what looks like at least to be some small improvement in the postal financials on their operational side as sort of a reason to stall reform. And it's all come down to what people think the future of the Postal Service should be. And the Postal Service needs this reform because they say they need large profits over a long period of time to be able to do things like improve their services and maintain their fleets, while opponents say that that's just an excuse to cut the workforce even further, and that if the Postal Service gets a little bit more time and maybe gets some of their retiree health benefit prepayments waived, then they're going to be fine.
Well, that's what many people, particularly in the union, say, is that they're the only ones that have to pre-fund retirement, that the rest of the federal government just does it on faith.
Right, and I think that's the one area of agreement, is that everyone agrees that there should be, or at least among postal employees and the organization itself, that there should be some waiving of that fee. But the Postal Service wants a lot more in terms of flexibility, in terms of workforce reductions, in terms of reforms there, while there are unions and some members of Congress that are hesitant, especially when they see at least some improvement in those financials. So that's the battle that's going on right now.
Well, unions aren't happy with this plan to put postal facilities in. Is it Staples?
That's correct. And they've even had some protests outside of that Staples center in D.C.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's the idea? The Postal Service, they're not moving postal employees in to sell services and products, these would be, what, Staples employees?
Yeah, the idea is that they're not. I think that's the sticking point, too, is that the Postal Service would not be using postal employees. So the unions are upset for what they see as sort of an outsourcing of the work to people that are not part of the organization, while the Postal Service says that they just want to reach more people, more places. So in a lot of locations, if you go into Staples or Office Max, there is a shipping company of some kind, and the Postal Service wants to be that shipping company.
But not have to pay the postal employee wages.
Right, Mike. You can't hide anything from you, and that's the huge sticking point.
Yeah, I would think so. At some point it seems like somebody's going to have to revisit what the post office is, the post office department, now the postal service, because it was set up as a sort of a thing to connect the country at as low cost as possible. And I know if you take a package into FedEx or UPS or any of them and say, I want this to go to Bering Point, Alaska, they'll say, rent a car. We're not going to take it. But the Postal Service will take it for I don't know what the stamp costs now. Is it 47 cents or something like that? But they promise universal delivery. And I think a lot of people, particularly in the computer age with email and all that, have forgotten that.
I think you're right. This all plays into what we talk about all the time, which is what is the role of the government. And the Postal Service, they have to deliver to every address, and that makes it a universal service. But at the same time, that costs money. But at the same time, as you said, people are switching from email, but also they're ordering from Amazon or they're ordering off of eBay. And so that business is really picking up, and I think most people would like to make sure that they get packages delivered to their address no matter where they live. So it's really about what people think the future of the Postal Service is and what it should be.
Lauren Larson's giving me the evil eye here, so we got to get away. Amber, thank you for being with us. Hope to see you here next week. Andy, thanks as always.
It's always a pleasure.
We'll see you next week.
Over the past 30 years, we said goodbye to rabbit ears and hello to HDTV. We said goodbye to the 8-track and hello to MP3s. We said goodbye to bank lines, rotary phones, and snail mail, and said hello to ATMs, mobility, and instant messaging. But the network that makes all this possible hasn't changed at all. It's time to say goodbye to the status quo network and hello to Brocade. It's time to say hello to a more efficient, agile, and speedy network. Get the facts at brocade.com/networkfacts.
Hey, Foodie and the Beast fans, join David and me, Nikki Nellis, next Saturday, May 3rd at the National Harbor Wine and Food Festival. We'll be doing our show live, and you get to participate. We have a panel of some of the area's best sommeliers blind tasting wine, and you get to sip along with us. That's Foodie and the Beast, live Saturday, May 3rd at 1 p.m. at the National Harbor Wine and Food Festival.
At any given moment, somewhere in America, a baby is taking a first step, a developmental milestone. But for too many parents, a baby's first steps aren't just a milestone, they're a miracle. These are the parents of babies who were born prematurely or with birth defects. It's a crisis affecting more than 500,000 babies in the United States each year. You can help them by joining volunteers like you who walk in March for Babies. The money you raise funds research and local programs that help babies overcome the challenges of premature birth and birth defects. Together, our steps make stronger, healthier babies a reality for thousands of families. Sign up today at marchforbabies.org to take the steps that help make milestones and even miracles possible. Who will you march for?
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Like Federal News Radio on Facebook for a look at some of the top federal stories each day. Plus, we'll give you a taste of what goes on behind the scenes. Find us at facebook.com/Federal News Radio.